The COVID-19 economic collapse in the U.S. has affected nearly every single industry, but it's looked a bit different for big tech.
People are just actually just enjoying how these technologies can help them connect to people.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, for Thursday, April 30th, a look at how technology companies are doing pretty well, while others struggle. In fact, one of those struggling industries is cannabis, which is not receiving assistance from the federal government due to its complicated legal status. Also, change and loss bring grief in many forms. We grieve together and alone.
Death is not the only loss that we experience, and we get to grieve whatever loss we are experiencing, even if it isn't as, quote, bad as somebody else's loss.
And The Takeaway is Tanzina Vega shares her thoughts on motherhood during a pandemic. First up, the thriving tech industry. In the latest sign of financial fallout from COVID-19, the Commerce Department announced Wednesday that U.S. gross domestic product fell at an annual rate of 4.8% in the first quarter of 2020. That's the biggest GDP drop the country's seen since the Great Recession of 2008, and is only expected to get worse in the coming months. But one industry is weathering the storm pretty darn well, and that's big tech. Giants like Google, Facebook, Apple, and Microsoft. Soon after the news about the GDP dive, Microsoft announced that its sales were up 15% and that COVID-19 had, quote, minimal net impact on the total company revenue. And even as ad revenue has plummeted across digital platforms, Facebook's first quarter earnings were also stronger than expected. As the world hunkered down to stop the spread of the virus, services like Facebook, YouTube, and Amazon became critical. And so they've seen demand surge.
They were not prepared for this, just like no one else in the world was prepared.
That's Elizabeth Dwoskin, Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. After several years marked by scrutiny from states and the federal government over concerns of power and privacy, tech giants are looking to capitalize on this moment when their services are in high demand. Elizabeth's been writing about all this, and she joined me from her home office, so you might hear a few things happening in the background. I asked her whether this new dynamic has created less contentious relationships between public officials and the tech companies.
I think it definitely softens the edges of some of the contentious relationships. I used the example in the story of Gavin Newsom, that's governor of California, his press conferences, and he's holding up modeling for the charting the course of the disease. And those models, some of them are coming from underlying data from companies like Google and Facebook. And so, especially in California, you see it because of the relationship of the tech companies to the state. But before, the state was adversarial with big tech. I mean, even when Governor Newsom came on board as governor, one of the first things he talked about was, like, you know, data is bill of rights for people. And, you know, so it's, and yet they're using the data that is collected now to model the course of coronavirus. So that in itself is a big reversal. And then I spoke with Gary Reback, who is a longtime antitrust lawyer who actually worked for the Department of Justice on the Microsoft case years ago. And now he's in private practice, and he represents a lot of these smaller, mid-sized companies that are bringing, that have some evidence that could maybe help the government in bringing its antitrust cases. And he was just saying that, you know, the companies are slowing down the investigations now, even though he said that, you know, the politicians themselves, the people who are working on these cases, say, we're not slowing down with the cases. We're not going to stop bringing these cases. But what's happening in practice is that the companies are saying, oh, our lawyers are working from home, so it's taking us a longer time to retrieve documents. You know, masses of documents need to be retrieved in discovery, and this is going to be harder, and there's really a slowdown.
I want to go back in time a little bit to 2008 and the recession that followed, something I covered looking at Washington and the banking industry. And I guess I was wondering, can you chart out what happened to the big tech companies, many of whom were much smaller then, and how the crash affected them?
You know, during the Great Recession, all of Wall Street got hit. And that speaks to the fact that the shareholder class had less money and they took their licks. and the whole economy, the whole market took its licks. But what happened afterwards is very interesting because the Great Recession also coincided with the advent of the smartphone. That moment of creating this, you know, the rise of the iPhone 2007, the rise of the App Store 2009, creates this explosion of businesses in Silicon Valley. You know, that's, you think of the startup boom, you know, an app for this, an app for that. Years later, people are using apps for this and that, but no one's really shopping on their phones. And this is a big question around, will people buy things on their smartphone? Will they, you know, they'll browse on their smartphone maybe, but the screens are too small. And the advertising industry itself was built around desktop. And so they hadn't actually even built ads that would really be clickable or work on a smartphone. Well, that is something that Facebook and Google figured out to great effect, because suddenly their apps and services became utilized so greatly and people were just flowing naturally from the desktop to the smartphone. And once the tech giants, they weren't even the tech giants then, the big tech companies solved that question. We weren't even, as reporters, using that term tech giants in every story. Once they solved that question, you really see their revenues just start to completely accelerate and kind of just catapult ahead of the rest of the digital advertising industry. The tech platforms become the hubs for all of our reading habits and material, and also on the back end, all of the measurement and delivery of ads that really fuels this, I don't know, $70 billion global industry. And so, you know, that suddenly, it's like people woke up to that. I want to say 2015, 2016, and all of a sudden you have these tech giants and everyone else is failing. And the recession that's going to come because of COVID is going to accelerate that. Like already, if you read like Ad Age, you'll see that there's been layoffs in digital advertising already. And these companies are already struggling against Google and Facebook. And, you know, these are also the companies that fuel the media. The Washington Post is just owned by Jeff Bezos. And if we weren't, we would be in the same boat. And so you just see them poised to take even more market share after this, just kind of accelerating some of the trends that made them big and powerful. Well, that makes them more able to withstand the crisis. And when sort of the smaller players that were already hanging on start to, you know, start to fail or shake and become fragile and fall apart, you know, that they grow even further.
You know, at the same time that all of this is happening, we're seeing protests against the tech companies, including from their own workers, these agonized public conversations about the morality of, say, ordering from Amazon when they have had, as you mentioned, COVID outbreaks in their facilities. Does any of that public conversation have an effect either on company behavior or, I guess, on how these companies are perceived more broadly?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, some people have responded to me in the article, like some readers have responded to me by saying, hey, you know, this crisis is going to give a lot more power to companies like Amazon. Amazon is clearly the winner of winners. But, you know, that's going to make them even more of a target when things settle down. And possibly it's true. You know, the fact that they're going to accrue more power at some point, that's going to become glaringly obvious. Right now, it's not as obvious, even though I'm trying to make, you know, sound the alarms around it. But also on the workers, you know, since journalists started, you know, writing about these protests, and there's been a lot of coverage of the worker protests, the companies have been pushed to improve the situation a bit. So now Amazon is doing a lot more than it did. And I think they just said now when people come back to work, they're going to be doing temperature checks and masks and gloves. And when we first started writing about this, you know, Amazon wasn't even providing sanitizer to workers in many facilities and was also not even enforcing the social distancing, because when you're in these facilities doing packing, you know, you're standing very close to people. And so they weren't doing 6 feet of distance. I see that the public pressure does appear to have an effect, but I don't know how much of an effect. And it's also like they're going to do the minimum to get by and still run their business. And so the public pressure really matters. Just the continuing to beat the drum of public pressure really matters. Cause I've seen as a tech reporter in the last 7 years, you know, that the companies do respond to it. You know, Facebook in particular, you know, now you know, they've raised the pay for their content moderators. You know, I have no illusions. They would not have done that had there not been so much scrutiny of the fact that thousands, tens of thousands of people who review the ugliest content on the internet with huge psychological consequences are getting paid $15, $16 an hour. And so the Facebook has raised their wages. You know, that wouldn't happen if there wasn't scrutiny.
We started this conversation talking about what people call the techlash, this backlash to the size and power of the tech companies. And yet they have, as your reporting shows, gained so much from this moment. Is it too early to try to figure out where COVID-19 tilts the techlash?
I think it's subtle in some ways, is that people are just having more positive experiences. Like, I think I've seen people talk about how they're having positive experiences on social media now that remind them of when social media first started in a more innocent time before people realized all the data that was being collected and all the exposure and the screen time. And, you know, that people are just actually just enjoying how these technologies can help them connect to people. I mean, people are loving, you know, all these intimate portraits actually of celebrities, like, you know, just looking into the living room of the celebrity and having them be more authentic. And there's like that whole idea of social media bringing authenticity, which we know, you know, has fallen by the wayside because now it's become performative and fake. And so, but you're seeing a lot of authenticity that's refreshing as well. So I think that there's just a feeling to that really actually helps morale at the tech companies. Like when you talk about the techlash, I think I've talked to people who say like the morale has really shifted, like at places like Facebook and certain parts of Google, just because like people are enjoying what they make and aren't complaining about it as much. They're depending on it. And so that affects morale. I mean, I think Facebook, which has taken like the biggest morale hit because they also had their Cambridge Analytica, they've just had more scandals than the others. And people at Facebook, like Facebook, for all the money it can pay people, has had trouble recruiting people even. And they can pay so much more than almost any startup. But people haven't wanted to work there because it's felt like it's an unethical company. And morale has been really low. And people always tell me, oh, I'm embarrassed to talk about that I work at Facebook at the family dinner party. People who joined Facebook so they could brag at the family dinner party. And now that's changed. And so I've talked to people who say like, well, now it's nice because my family's using Portal, their camera, you know, it's their webcam. People are talking about it again. And, you know, it wasn't an accident that Sheryl Sandberg, you know, Mark Zuckerberg has been on a media tour. And it's no accident that they broadcast that they're hiring 10,000 people. None of the other companies besides Amazon have really gone so far to say, we're hiring thousands of people by the end of this year. It was almost saying, you know, give me you're tired, you're laid off of Silicon Valley and come work for us, finally.
Elizabeth Dwoskin, Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you can hear an extended version of this interview on tomorrow's episode of Slate's podcast, What Next TBD, where you can find me hosting a tech and future themed episode every Friday. And another friend of WNYC, Mary Harris, hosts What Next Monday through Thursday. You can find them both wherever you get your podcasts. Congress passed the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, also known as the CARES Act, in part to alleviate the strain on small businesses. But one industry that is not feeling the benefits of the bailout is the cannabis industry. Those businesses aren't eligible for any of that money. To understand how the industry is surviving and what existing problems have been exacerbated by the pandemic, we're joined by Allison Martin, co-founder and editor of Cannabis Wire and an adjunct professor at the Columbia School of Journalism. Allison, thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
Why are these cannabis companies not eligible for aid? And I guess what has the reaction been within the cannabis industry?
So there's one simple reason for this. It's that the cannabis industry remains federally illegal and these are federal programs.
And, you know, there were some issues that already existed prior to the pandemic within the cannabis industry, banking being one of the biggest ones. How does COVID-19 exacerbate some of these pre-existing things?
Yeah, so there was a bit of a bubble that burst last year that included cutbacks and layoffs. There was a lot of excitement about the potential of the cannabis industry, but then the sort of like regulatory realities, I guess I would say, set in. You know, the cannabis industry has faced major financial hurdles because of the lack of access to banking. From basic banking services to bankruptcy protection. You know, there was a big push for the Safe Banking Act last year, which got the historic vote in the House. But, you know, whereas that had some traction, it seems to have lost momentum. And, you know, these businesses were already facing short runways and sort of uncertainty about overall cannabis regs.
So does that mean that if you, say, ran a dispensary or another business, you had to deal in cash?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that created a bunch of other hurdles, like, you know, potential, you know, hotspots for burglary and those sorts of things. So The Safe Banking Act has definitely been, you know, foremost in the minds of the cannabis industry. And I would say that's probably the legislation outside of this COVID-related funding that the industry has its sights set on.
One thing that I found fascinating is that in some states, the cannabis industry is considered essential. It seems so weird to have something that is essential and yet not available for government aid. Why is it considered essential?
Yeah, so this is the one that's the most confounding, I think. So, like, there's sort of a philosophical thing at play here. Is cannabis a medicine or is cannabis a nightcap? You know, in the context of COVID, both pharmacies and liquor stores have been declared essential. And I think that's why the vast majority of states have also declared cannabis businesses essential. So to be clear, the cannabis industry has been declared essential most places except Massachusetts, where Governor Charlie Baker closed all non-essential businesses. And while medical sales were considered essential, adult use or quote-unquote recreational sales weren't. So a group of cannabis businesses actually sued Baker over the decision to close the adult use shops, but a Suffolk Superior Court judge denied the request by the businesses to reopen during the pandemic. So it's a very interesting aspect of the patchwork of the cannabis industry. I mean, I've never seen another industry that was such a patchwork, and it's, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic is really highlighting that.
Are there any other industries that are being excluded from federal relief, or is this unique to cannabis?
You know, I haven't found another industry that's facing this kind of situation where not only are small businesses hurting and not having the access to this relief funding, but there's also this like state-by-state patchwork approach to like pandemic restrictions. You know, some states are allowing delivery, others aren't. There are differences in like sort of the social distancing rules. So, I mean, the short answer to your question is just that I haven't seen another industry with similar hurdles during the pandemic.
What about people who work in the industry? You know, we have heard and have been covering on this show stories of struggles of migrant farm workers. Do the workers who grow cannabis struggle with some of the same challenges right now?
Sure. So we haven't seen a ton of specifics on this, but the workers are facing the same sorts of things that they're facing in other industries. So yes, it is an agricultural commodity. So, you know, ag workers are dealing with social distancing rules. You know, dispensary or shop workers are also, you know, dealing with, you know, complete shifts in their businesses and those sorts of things. It would be like if you think about like, you know, anything from, you know, other ag workers in other industries to, like I was saying before, like, you know, liquor store workers or, you know, pharmacy workers, those sorts of things. Anything that's top down for those industries are going to be things that for the most part, the industry will have to deal with as well.
When we think about disasters and the kinds of things people turn to for comfort, don't disasters historically help the sales of things like alcohol and cannabis? And I guess, is there any way to know how the industry is doing overall right now?
Sure, that's a really good question. It's one I've been talking about a lot because traditionally during economic downturns and other crises, of course, you know, vices like alcohol, tobacco, cannabis tend to do better, if that's how you think about things, with sales. So here's the thing with the cannabis industry. It, in general, I think it's going to trend upward. It will eventually rebound, and it's a nascent industry, and it will, you know, eventually get back on its feet. You know, there are these sort of looming questions right now, which is like, you know, tied to the election, for example. I think the cannabis industry in 2020 and 2021 will look different if Donald Trump is reelected or if Joe Biden is elected. I think the industry will look different if, you know, these pending FDA rules on CBD are particularly restrictive. So there are these kind of like giant regulatory question marks that also play into this moment in time. But I think overall, I don't think the cannabis industry is going anywhere. It's just a matter of how fast it grows.
So it could change once we get to the election in the fall. And I guess I should say whatever voting looks like in the fall.
Absolutely. And I can't underscore that importance enough, because really, when we talk about the hurdles that the industry is facing today, probably the biggest one is that access to banking services and the access to just simple lines of credit and bankruptcy protection and those sorts of things. You know, if cannabis was descheduled or rescheduled, if, you know, they were able to have access to federal programs and those sorts of things, I mean, it would be a completely different ball game. And I think that would be something that would be in play if Biden was elected. I'm not so sure if Trump was elected.
Allison Martin is the co-founder of Cannabis Wire and an adjunct professor at the Columbia School of Journalism. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Andrea Cabral is the CEO of Ascend Massachusetts, a recreational marijuana business with two dispensaries set to open soon in the Boston area. And she joins us now. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
So how has the shutdown of recreational sales impacted your business and your company's stability?
Well, as most people know, the industry got something of a slow start. The adult recreational industry got something of a slow start in Massachusetts. And so it was really just getting its feet under it. And the adult use for recreational, these are not vertically integrated companies. So the retail dispensaries were suddenly just faced with either not opening at all, or if they had just opened, they were faced with having to close down before they could actually generate any real revenue.
What do you hear from other people in the industry in your state? Are they worried that they're going to have to close permanently if, you know, the governor doesn't allow recreational sales to start again?
I think that's a real possibility for a number of companies, which is unfortunate because, you know, as you know, there's no access to federal banking.
Yeah.
And so the funding is all, you know, private equity funding or private funding of another type. And, you know, that money doesn't hang around forever. And so people are having to make some really hard choices. And customers, who are a large portion of whom are also medical patients, are having to make some very serious choices as well. They can either apply for medical cards, and we've seen a spike of over 5,000 additional people applying for medical cards in order to buy on the medical market just in the last month, or it will drive people to the illicit market, which is a huge concern.
You know, the governor of Massachusetts has said he was worried that people from out of state would come into the state to buy marijuana and potentially spread COVID-19. Do you think that would have been an issue? And did you see out-of-state buyers as a potential big market for you?
Well, there certainly are people who come from other states to buy in Massachusetts. I think that's true all across the country. If you have a state where it is not legal, people, you know, will travel to a state where it is legal. And I should say also, I understand, you know, the governor's concern. We're in the middle of a pandemic. These are unprecedented times. I think the issue for the industry was that we wanted to be able to show that, like in other states where adult use is legal, but adult use has been deemed essential, there are lots of steps that recreational dispensaries can take in order to provide safe service to customers during a pandemic. And we recently had a Superior Court judge in a case confirm that the governor does have the authority to ban outside customers from outside Massachusetts from making purchases inside Massachusetts. I think the industry would join him in that effort. And then we can provide safe service in Massachusetts to Massachusetts customers. And we're just asking for the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, your company was part of a group that filed suit against Governor Baker. Why did you choose to go through the court system?
Well, it really was just to get some clarity around issues such as the one about the governor's authority to ban out-of-staters from coming into Massachusetts to make cannabis purchases. And as I said, you know, his concern was about the lines that would create or any crowding that would create. And, you know, we got some clarity around some other issues in that language. And the judge essentially agreed with us and said there are measures that cannabis companies can take that can provide safe service, as long as, you know, the judge didn't say this specifically, but we would put those measures in place. And I would say that as long as we're being careful with curbside service, reserve ahead only, everyone observing safe protocols, masking, hand washing, hand sanitizing, all of those things, those are things that I think companies would readily put in place in order to stay in business. And, you know, it's not just about the tax revenue to the state, But this is an industry that is employing over 240,000 people nationwide and 20,000 people in Massachusetts. That's a big deal. And, you know, the tax revenue was built in even before this pandemic. And so to lose that on top of all of the other tax revenue is significant for the state.
You know, we know that you're not eligible for the federal aid packages. Has the state done anything or have you been able to find different avenues to make money during this pandemic?
Well, for Ascend specifically, our retail store in Boston is under construction and a ban was put on construction about a month ago. So we haven't been able to move forward on that. We do have Mass Grow, which is our cultivation in Athol, Massachusetts, and that has been operating as a result of an amended order from the Cannabis Control Commission. We're allowed to continue to cultivate as long as what we transfer out of the facility and wholesale is kept in the medical supply chain. That has its own challenges, but we're continuing to operate. The state has not put in any relief measures financially for cannabis companies. And you are absolutely correct that we are unable to avail ourselves of any federal relief.
Andrea Cabral is CEO of Ascend Massachusetts, a marijuana dispensary company. Thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Every memory you think you have of the past.
The house you grew up in, your first kiss.
It's not simply an idea. It's a physical trace left in your brain.
I own those memories. They define me.
But what happens when those memories are stolen from you?
In the blink of an eyelid.
Can you imagine what to have one night 20 years long? That's what it's been like. Just like death.
Memory and Forgetting on Radiolab. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
All week, we've been talking about grief and the different forms it's taking during this pandemic. From the death of loved ones from COVID-19 to the disruption of our everyday routines.
Grief is our reaction to loss. It is a emotional reaction, but it also is a physical, cognitive, and oftentimes spiritual response to loss.
That's Sonia Lott, a licensed psychologist in Philadelphia specializing in grief. So often, we think about grief only in response to the death of someone we care about. But it's much more than that. Grief can happen with any kind of loss, a marriage, a job, physical touch, you name it. We're all grieving someone or something right now. I asked Sonia if we've ever experienced this level of collective grief before.
The closest that we've come to it was with 9/11. 3,000 people were killed. However, we're experiencing the death of 3,000 or more people per day at this time, and this has been going on for almost 2 months that we are aware of, and we really don't see an end in sight. This collective grief that we're experiencing around the world, I don't believe we've ever experienced before in this way.
How does collective grief express itself? I mean, I feel like I watch on social media, and right now, people are so angry. Is that an outpouring of grief?
Under the circumstances, it absolutely can be. In terms of what emotions we experience when we're grieving, it's individualized for each of us each time we experience a loss. And even if we limit that to the loss of loved ones, it's different every time. It doesn't always include anger, but when we have circumstances where people feel like, for example, we're not being supported by our government, or we don't have things like adequate testing, or people are being ignored or not being given opportunities for treatment under the current circumstances. People are feeling like, how could this have been avoided or not have escalated to the extent that it has? There is a lot of anger on the part of many people in terms of how the pandemic has been handled.
I guess I wonder how these things knit together, the sort of individual loss that people feel when you're trying to make sense of a death, or even, you know, if you're a little kid losing
your time with your friends and your school experience, and then this larger collective bucket. How do those things bounce off one another and interact?
Well, it makes grief more complex. And in part, it's because we don't always recognize non-death losses as losses that deserve our grief process or deserve to be honored by a grief process. So we don't always give name to that, but we talk about those often as secondary losses. And so we have to be able to recognize that death is not the only loss that we experience, and that we get to grieve whatever loss we are experiencing, even if it isn't as, quote, bad as somebody else's loss. So it's more complicated, it's more compounded. And that's one of the things that's unique to this pandemic, is that many people have lost their employment. People are losing the social connection, or the physical connection, I should say. We've learned how to stay connected via technology, but that actual hugging each other, we really shouldn't be doing. And when we are in grief individually or collectively, or if we're just even anxious, a hug goes a long way. And so when we're in grief or we're in fear, we gather together, and we're not able to do that. So that's a huge loss that we often can't even give language to. We don't even know what it is.
Does the fact that we can't do that right now complicate grief even more?
Absolutely. Absolutely it does. Our grief needs to be witnessed. It complicates it more because our grief needs to be witnessed, and there's less opportunity for that. And it's also that we're losing the opportunity to be present with our loved ones when they're dying. The other thing too, because so many of us are grieving so many losses, it's harder for us to be present for other people, to hold space for their loss.
When I think about Americans, and particularly modern American culture, we don't talk about death and loss that much. How would you characterize the way Americans kind of relate to and experience grief before the pandemic?
Well, we acted as if it was something to be present to for about 3 days, maybe 5 days, depending on your place of employment, how many days you would get off to take care of your business.
Yeah.
And then to get back to work. You know, we don't have permission in American society to openly grieve. We just don't have it. We're so uncomfortable with death and dying and living, actually. And there really isn't space for people to fully move through their grief and to get through the tasks that are so important to get to the, quote, other side of grief, if you will, or for to allow our grief to become more integrated.
You know, I think a lot of people may have heard of this sort of classic five stages of grief that are often referred to in popular culture.
Yeah.
Denial,
yeah.
Anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Do those apply here?
They never apply, and I really appreciate you asking that question. I end up seeing people who have had their grief complicated for believing that their grief process should have looked like this, and when it didn't, they felt that something was wrong with them. What happens is that it becomes easier for us to think about this messy, long-term process that we call grief as something simplistic, that we can just understand these stages. So the stages don't apply. And also, it gets confusing because the stage of, quote, depression, if you will, needs to clearly be distinguished from a grief process. If someone has a clinical depression, they're going to look very similar to somebody in grief, but the, quote, treatment or the course of action is very, very different. Also, these, quote, stages only have to do with the emotional reactions that happen versus all of the physical manifestations, headaches, you know, inability to concentrate, a cognitive one, doubting your religious beliefs, which happens sometimes, that spiritual component.
You know, one thing we've covered a lot on this show is the disproportionate impact that the virus is having on poor communities, communities of color.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if grief looks different in historically marginalized populations or manifests differently.
I really appreciate that question, Lizzie. Grief is the same for all of us. It's unique for each of us, but it's a universal occurrence. And grief, as it relates to the loss of a loved one, it's the same tasks that we need to move through. It's the same set of these overwhelming emotions, because love and connection are universal. But we may have different ways or rituals around grieving loved ones, funeral services or not, that type of thing.
What support can we give one another right now? How do we help others grieve while we're also experiencing grief?
One, we are in grief, even if we don't even know anybody who's died yet, let alone a loved one. So knowing that, and knowing that we deserve to honor our grief, that it's okay to have privilege, you know, in this situation, to acknowledge that privilege, but to still feel the loss of the things that were or have been important to you, grieving the loss of the illusion of control that we walk through the world with until something like this happens. You know, that's a big deal. That's how we hold ourselves together collectively and individually, is to think that we have some control over our lives. And that's shattered. And so it's to have the awareness of the collective losses and to recognize that the grief process, even though it looks different, if it's not in relation to a loved one, but that there are this collective grief and the individual grief, it's fatiguing. It makes it difficult to concentrate. So that's a big part of it. Mm-hmm. Being socially connected as much as possible is so, so important. Even when we can't hug, you know, getting together, having friend meetings, family meetings on Zoom or whatever technology, staying connected, talking about how you're feeling, being just present and being able as much as you can to witness somebody else's grief. And try not to get into my grief is worse than yours, or, I can't grieve this because, you know, at least I have a job kind of thing. And just being so much more gentle with ourselves. Give to yourself what you would give to somebody else if they were in this situation, which is what we all are in. But recognizing that your needs and filling your cup, if you will, still is first on your list. You can't really give to others if you're not, you know, replenish yourself. So being kind to yourself, doing your best to take care of yourself, and then trying to be as available to other people as possible.
Sonia Lott is a licensed psychologist specializing in grief based in Philadelphia. Thank you so much for joining us and for talking about all this.
Thank you so much. I'm so grateful to be here.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Tanzina Vega. Tanzina is on maternity leave, and she recently wrote for the New York Times about the experience of being at home alone with her newborn as the chaos of COVID-19 swirls around outside.
The nature of this pandemic left me in a situation that I was not expecting, which was to be totally isolated suddenly. It was sort of like because of the way that we were all being told to stay home. So my mom had to stay home, my son's father had to stay home, and suddenly I realized that a lot of the support that we often assume that we have, we may not have it, or it may not always be there for us. And there are folks who are probably struggling with the same thing. Maybe it's not that you're home with a newborn, but maybe it's just you're homebound and you can't get out. Or what I wanted people to realize was, let's not assume that everybody is just doing okay. Let's not assume that everybody has networks that they can just fall back on. At any moment, any one of us could find ourselves in a situation that's really over our heads.
All of this hits pretty close to home for me because I'm 30 weeks pregnant myself. That has meant doctor's appointments and even one unplanned trip to the hospital in the middle of a pandemic. And honestly, I'm not sure what kind of world I'll be raising my newborn in. So with Tanzina a few months ahead of me in this process, we decided to chat. With her baby son sleeping nearby, she talked me through her experience of early motherhood in this unique moment.
I'm 45 and I'm a first-time mother, so this is all new to me. Entering into this space is all new to me. Like, it will be for you.
Yeah, I'm 44, right? And I'm about going to have my first child in July.
So we have much to talk about, because there are many first things, you know, that you begin to realize. And I think, speaking for myself, one thing that surprised me even before the pandemic and the severity of the situation began to change was just how women mothers started reaching out to me. Like, women who I knew maybe, you know, through work or, you know, through more tenuous connections, just suddenly started texting or DMing or finding me on Twitter and just sending all of these lovely little notes. And I thought, well, that's really nice of them. Like, just kind of, you know, me being this independent person used to not having to rely on anything, and all of a sudden getting all these women reaching out. And slowly but surely, in new motherhood, you begin to understand that women do that because it's hard. You know, it's beautiful and it's wonderful and it's earth shattering and it's changing your life, but it's really hard.
I'm curious if you have advice for me. You know, while I have been pregnant, hospital policies in New York have shifted dramatically. Mm-hmm. It does seem at this point that I will be able to have one well person with me. But I don't know what postpartum life is going to look like. I don't want my mother in her 70s coming into New York City. What bits of wisdom do you have for someone who's 30 weeks pregnant?
And right behind me, we're really right behind each other. What I can say, as I learn, as we all are learning every day, is, you know, in the midst of all this, and this is one of the things I wrote in the piece as well, was, you know, there's so much stress right now, particularly around doctor's visits and everything else. And, you know, I think obviously I know you're probably taking the utmost precautions. And I'm even being crazy about it in a little way, you know, just like, oh my God, do I have alcohol wipes? Do I have this? Do I have that? At the same time, this quarantine has given me, it's almost given me a forced moment in many ways to bond in a way that I just don't think would have been possible if I was, you know, didn't have a generous maternity leave plan and was still kind of, you know, thinking about other things. And you're really one-on-one with your child. And there's a beauty to that that I don't think should get lost in the moment. I think that's something that I've realized, wow, I'm really getting to know my son in like very intimate ways, right? And the flip side to that is that there isn't anybody else, you know, that he's able to get the cuddles and the hugs and everything else from grandma, or, you know, initially we were doing that, but now we can't do that. And so It's sad. And I think what I've done is, you know, I created my first ever family group chat, and I'm indulging in the fact that I'm the last, well, potentially the last person in my generation to have a child. So I'm indulging in the fact that everyone else has already sent all the baby pictures out. And so I can text as many baby pictures as I want. So set one of those up. No one can say anything to you. Bring the baby to Zoom meetings and Zoom family calls. They will love that. Give the baby literally all of the cuddles. It's almost like a lot of the stuff that you're reading, and I'm sure you're reading about all, you know, all the mom books and all the trajectories and how to raise the baby. And there came a point in which I had to say, you know what, I just want to cuddle you and just hold you for a minute, you know, because the world is so crazy right now. Like, it does force you to stop and pause. And so I would indulge all of those moments that you're going to have, you know, with the baby. Those intimate moments that I really hope that you're able to enjoy, even though you're stepping outside right now is nuts.
Have you been able to think at all about what you're going to tell him when he's a little bit older about this time?
So one of our engineers on the show, Jay, joked with me about how I will always be able to hold this as a point of leverage, that I raised you in the middle of a pandemic.
That goes far and beyond, like, I gave birth to you. Exactly. I was in labor for so long. Yeah.
Right. So I think there's that, you know. I have tried keeping, I wouldn't say a faithful diary every day, but I have tried writing a couple of notes, you know, every couple mornings, especially those mornings when you're up at 3 or 4 a.m. and it's really quiet. Just jotting down a couple notes about, you know, what I'm thinking that day and, you know, what decisions I'm making, you know, about him and about our care and about everything else. And maybe like little milestones that he may have made, like now he's able to turn over, you know, on his belly. Yeah. And so it's like, oh, you were able to do that, you know. This is a historic moment. And I think, you know, he will know, you know, I was just saying, is his generation going to be a generation that looks at us and says, why are you guys always washing your hands? And, you know, like, and you're so concerned about toilet paper, right? Like, are we going to turn into that generation? We might, you know.
We might.
But the biggest thing I want to be able to give him is a chance at really surviving the insanity of the future. And that's really what's driving me. And I think he might be waking up. Yeah.
He is. Tanzina Vega is the host of The Takeaway. She's on maternity leave right now, and she's back in about a month's time. Thank you very much for spending a little time with us today. I really appreciate it.
Lizzie, thank you for everything that you're doing on the show. And I am here for any and all questions, on or offline.
I will have them.
Yeah, no, I've got as many answers as you've got questions, I hope.
I am definitely going to be taking Tanzina up on that offer. And before I sign off, after a month behind the mic for The Takeaway, I want to thank the team that puts this show together every day. Our board operators, Claire McKean and Debbie Daughtry, are in the studio at WNYC every week for us, alongside Vince Fairchild, who was our director this week, with an assist from director and editor Jay Cowett. Alexandra Boti is our senior producer. Producers this week are Jose Olivares, Ethan Oberman, Jackie Martin, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, Dina Syed Ahmed, and Lydia McMullen Laird. Polly Arungu is our digital editor. Katarina Barton is our intern, and David Gable is our executive assistant. Lee Hill is our executive producer. Amy Walter is with you tomorrow, and Shamita Basu joins as guest host starting on Monday. You can always find me on Twitter. I'm at Lizzie O'Reilly. Thank you so much for listening. It's been a pleasure being with you this month. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is The Takeaway.